get the meeting called to order of Govern Operations. Representative Earhart. And we don't have any minutes left yet for today, for the past meeting. So, Representative Earhart, you can welcome to our committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Would you make a motion so we can talk about this, please?
I'll move that House File 745 be recommended to pass and be referred to Transportation Policy.
Thank you. House File 745 is a bill that would authorize municipalities to establish street improvement districts. It follows legislation that allows cities to establish sidewalk improvement districts. It's enabling legislation. It is not a mandate. It's up to the cities to make it go if, in fact, they choose to use the tool. And it comes about because there are many cities who receive no money from the formula that distributes the road monies through the county state aid and the trunk highways and the local units, because some cities are too small to receive any monies through that source. And moreover, the cities have, metro cities particularly, have enormous needs that are not being satisfied. I think that we should allow someone here to explain this bill. I don't know if Deb Dyson is here. Yes, no?
Deb Dyson is here, yes. She's sitting up here.
Oh, yeah. Are you prepared to run through the bill?
Ms. Dyson?
The technical aspects?
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, the street improvement district bill, it applies only to cities. The first section defines various terms such as improvements and what improvements may include and what maintenance includes, what street is, and then what the district is. And the district can include, as I believe, under subdivision 5, can be a citywide. As the author stated, this is authorization. It's not a requirement that cities establish it, but provides an additional method of paying for street improvements. Under subdivision 3, you'll see that it says that it requires the cost of street improvements and maintenance to be apportioned on all parcels or tracts of land in the district on a uniform basis within each real estate classification. Before implementing a street improvement district, the city has to have adopted a plan after notice and public hearing that identifies the districts before the fee can be imposed, and that the fees are to be imposed for at least 5 years and no more than 20 years. The use of the fees under subdivision 6, they're to be placed in a separate account and used only for projects in the district that are identified in the adopted plan. And then it requires, under subdivision 8, it requires a public hearing on the fee ordinance before it is voted on or adopted. And then finally on subdivision 9, it provides that that it's not the exclusive means of financing improvements, but it would prohibit imposing a special assessment for a project that's funded with a street improvement fee, but otherwise allows cities to use any other method of financing street improvements or maintenance within the city. And it would be effective July 1st.
The, Mr. Chairman, the 745 is it was initiated by the League of Minnesota Cities and supported by Metro Cities, the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, the Minnesota Association of Small Cities, the North Metro Mayors, the City Engineers Association of Minnesota, Minnesota Transportation Alliance. We have...
I see you have a testifier up there. If you can identify yourself for the tape, then proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Lee Gustafson. I'm with the City of Minnetonka. And I'm here also representing the City Engineers Association as well as the Minnesota Public Works Association. I do have a handout here that the committee can take with them. Essentially, the handout is to really stress one point.
You can give it to the page and pass it out.
And handout really represents, in order to maintain our roads, we need to do the right repair at the right time. No different than in the roof on your house. If you let the roof go, you're going to have additional repairs, and it's going to be much more costly in the future and in the end. This handout gives you the nature of the cost, and by delaying repairs in your streets, your cost goes considerably. And hopefully that chart will just give you a clean one-page reference to keep with you and use for future reference. But costs on the road increase substantially the longer we wait. And by providing this funding mechanism that's before you today, will help cities ensure that some of these repairs are done at the right time. The groups that I represent, the City Engineers and the Public Works Association, support this funding mechanism for several reasons. First and foremost, the special assessments are getting very hard to use nowadays with the proof of benefit. But also, probably more importantly, that most people don't realize, when you specially assess a project, it adds a lot of money to the project cost. This cost is used to put together assessment rolls and prepare everything that's needed to specially assess a project. This money, by using this funding mechanism, this money would be saved and would actually save the taxpayers and the business owners within each of these cities a substantial amount of money over the years. Also, it allows this funding mechanism to be used as was described and how it could be implemented differently in each situation. Two good examples that I'd like to leave with you is that when you specially assess a project, it's a snapshot in time. And if you get a new resident that moves in, a very young couple, or you get a new business owner that moves in, when you specially assess a project, it hits that business owner or hits that resident right then and there. So the legislation allows a pay-as-you-go feature. You pay a little bit each year to use the streets within that street improvement district. Special assessment hits that business owner, hits that new resident right away with a substantial amount of money. More importantly is that the street improvement district or the money that would be obtained by using a district is tax deductible and also saves the taxpayers money. Special assessments aren't. So not only if you could save money by using this funding mechanism, you save money by not specially assessing, you also save money by allowing the business owner and the property owner the means of deducting this on their taxes. I'll just end with this. Both our organizations strongly support this. The city strongly support this. It's not a new fund. It's a funding mechanism that allows cities to really design their projects in a way that makes them very accountable to their residents and their property owners and their taxpayers, and also provides them a means to really save their taxpayers money by choosing the right funding mechanism for certain situations. Be more than happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Questions of the testifier? If not, I also have a Jacob Milner.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape. And
thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, we're going to have some negative reports from some of the people here. When they testified in the last committee, I asked that if they can't go along with this, that they come up with a suitable alternative to raise money for their businesses, which they're supporting here, because the businesses depend on good roads, and we need some other ideas if they can't count and seize. So I asked Mr. Milner to come up with an alternative suggestion, and I gave him 24 hours. I haven't heard from him yet. since his testimony in the last committee. So I expect today he's going to have a positive solution for what we're trying to do here. Thank you.
Mr. Milner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jacob Milner, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. And I wanted to express MADA's opposition to House File 745. In addition to us, there are over 20 organizations, and actually it's 25 at my last count, of organizations ranging from nonprofits to faith organizations to businesses to business associations opposed to this bill for several reasons. And I'm going to offer a few brief remarks, and then a few of my colleagues will offer remarks as well. Our first concern is that this bill gives broad authority to municipalities to increase taxes for transportation improvement projects. We believe that there already exist several taxing mechanisms available at the municipal level to allow them to raise money to pay for transportation projects. Under this proposal, there's no need for a city to prove benefits to the affected property to justify imposing this new fee. It is conceivable that your property could be located within the taxing district but not be located near the road improvements or get any benefit from the road improvements. Nonetheless, the city could still impose this tax on your property to finance it. Additionally, cities under this legislation are free to draw taxing districts in any shape, allowing them to impose a tax on only certain properties. This is unfair. Nothing would prohibit a city from imposing the street improvement fees in such a way that minimally affects voting homeowners, while instead burdening commercial property owners whose owners oftentimes do not live or vote in the communities that their business is located. There is seemingly no limit on how a city can devise the fee system under this legislation. The street improvement fees authorized by this bill also do not sunset after a particular project has been paid for. Rather, the fees can be collected from the property owners for up to 20 years and can presumably be renewed after the 20-year period expires. Finally, property owners are already paying for street improvements through property taxes and other taxing mechanisms. And for these reasons, I encourage you to reject this bill. And you'll hear from a few others opposed to this bill as well. But again, I just want to reiterate that there's over 25 organizations running from business organizations, and those organizations are listed on this one pager you have in front of you who have some serious concerns and are opposed to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Milner. Is there any questions for the testifier? If not, the next person on my list is Ann Finn.
Where is the list?
It's on the agenda. Ms. Finn, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. Unfortunately, not here today is Mayor John Hanlon from the city of Chatfield. He actually came last week when this bill was on the agenda, and I wanted to just distribute his written testimony since he was unable to be here today.
We'll get it to the page. Page, we have a...
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, currently 84% of city streets are paid for with a combination of property taxes, local government aid, and special assessments. They're not paid for with the gas tax, not state bonding money, not federal money, and not with a number of the mechanisms that the opponents to this legislation have identified. There really are only three, and that is the property taxes, special assessments, and local government aid for city streets. According to the state auditor, a current report shows that 21% of city budgets go to street maintenance and reconstruction. That's about $630 million a year. Unfortunately, the existing funding mechanisms are not working as well as necessary. There are limits to each one. Property taxes have been subject to levy limits, which have blinked on and off in recent years. And further, tax-exempt properties do not pay property taxes. Some cities have more than 50% tax-exempt properties within their jurisdictions. Local government aid has been a volatile source of revenue, especially in recent years, and some cities don't receive local government aid. And finally, special assessments. They can be used for construction and reconstruction, but not for maintenance. And as you see from the chart that Mr. Gustafson handed out, for every $1 a city spends on maintenance, they save about $7 in repair and reconstruction costs. Special assessments, as you heard, have a benefit test. In other words, the amount assessed cannot exceed the amount that the project increases the property value. They are also not deductible for tax purposes. Many cities have experienced challenges to the benefit test, and we did a quick survey of some of our city attorneys and found a number of examples. The city of Maplewood has currently 45 appeals on three different projects pending. The city of St. Michael spent $60,000, litigating $500,000 worth of special assessments. The city of Hampton is reconsidering doing a reconstruction project because one property owner is challenging an assessment in the amount of $5,436. Some cities no longer are using special assessments because they know the benefit test is too onerous, particularly with the instability in the housing market. And the cities do not want to tie up public money in litigation. With this bill, the League is simply seeking enabling legislation that would give city councils one more tool. This bill is not an end run around property taxes, nor is it a way to manipulate street funding so that certain properties are placed at a financial disadvantage. We have tried to craft this bill in a way that is as fair as possible, and you have the commitment of the League of Minnesota Cities that we will help cities implement this tool in the fairest and most efficient way possible. And one last point, we have offered to work with the opponents of this legislation to address their concerns. We've offered to cap the allowable fee. We've offered to establish a formula for the fee structure. We've inserted language into the bill that prohibits cities from imposing special assessments on projects that are funded with street improvement district fees. We've offered to impose a supermajority threshold for a council to establish a street improvement district. You'll note that there are no amendments to this bill, and that's because the opponents have simply refused to work with us on this initiative. I would ask you to keep this in mind when listening to the opposing testimony. Every one of the entities you'll be hearing from today rely on having a robust transportation infrastructure. And the city street system, where many of their businesses are located, is integral to this robust system. I want to thank you for hearing this bill today, and I'm here to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Finn. Any questions of the testifier? Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Ms. Finn and Representative Earhart, have you brought forward an amendment to provide for reverse referendum so that taxpayers have an ability to react to this and take back control of their city if they believe that their city elected officials are overreaching?
Ms. Finn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Druskowski, we have not brought forward a reverse referendum. We think that city councils are capable of using any authority that they have, and that they will be accountable to their residents and businesses for the decisions that they make.
Mr. President Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Ms. Finn, I find that somewhat disappointing. I mean, you just got done scolding the opponents for the bill for not bringing forward amendments to bring this to be something more reasonable. And you guys seem to be digging in your feet, too, is what I'm seeing here. As we look at the authority that cities and counties have to bond for capital improvements, there is naturally a reverse referendum built into that process. And I would expect we would consider the same types of protections for the taxpayers of Minnesota in this situation. It seems like a natural fit. I'm really disappointed you don't have that in here.
Representative
Mr. Chairman, do you have a reverse referendum when they assess your property? You do not. I don't know if you've noticed that or not. Maybe you've never done any assessments in your town for property, for road uses or any other use. You don't do it. Not done.
Representative Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Finn, a couple questions for you relative to the scope and nature of the application of the proposed bill within municipalities. We had about 3 weeks ago, plus or minus, Representative Steve Simon was before the committee talking about Chapter 428, which is the ability for private associations to partner with cities to raise money for improvement of properties by forming special districts. 745 would be another additional layer that would be used and applied, or would this be in place of the 428 legislation that Representative Simon brought forward? And I believe the League of Minnesota Cities had been involved in that discussion as well, and that's why I bring it forward, just to help provide some clarification for the committee regarding that topic.
Ms. Finn, I see you're phoning a friend.
Yep. Representative O'Driscoll, Heather Cederholm has taken the lead on that initiative, and I'll let her answer that question.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape and answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Heather Cederholm. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. As you know, Charlie Vander Aarde from Metro Cities and I were before you a couple weeks ago, as you said, to present the bill that would repeal the sunset for a special service district in the downtown retail area. So that authority is specific for retail districts in a downtown area, and the assessed group, so basically the property owners, come before the city to ask for that increased level of service, whether it be a snow plowing, flowers, signage, lighting, increased public safety. So I think the services provided are very different from what Finn's bill would do. Does that answer your question?
Representative O'Driscoll, I think what you were asking is whether this would be on top of that, of that assessment, and I think the answer of that would, if I heard her right, is yes, it would be on top of that.
Mr. Chair, that's how I heard it as well, and I guess I'm concerned that we could have special assessments, a 428 levy, and now what I'll call, for the lack of a better term, Bill 745 levies that go on to property owners, and that might have the unintended consequence of making properties less affordable or less productive in a particular area. So I'm wondering if we haven't maybe hit a point of a tipping point possibly on some properties and communities as a result of this. And I was also the one that brought up that committee 429 issue that we're experiencing, which is the ability to be able to assess for the value of improvements to properties as relates to the amount of dollars that are assessed for special assessments. And so some of those may have to be rolled back into the general property tax levy, which would be spread against all property owners. So I'm wondering if we're really solving the problem or just chasing the problem with this.
Representative Earhart, or...
I'm not familiar with whatever you guys are talking about.
Yeah, I think that's more of a tax. Representative Earhart and Representative O'Driscoll, those more tax discussions, and I think this would have to end up in taxes too. So, thank you. Any more questions for Ms. Finn? I think Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Finn, I'm just wondering, what exactly can be assessed? Do you have a list of all the things that can be assessed, or is it limitless?
Ms. Finn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, it's right in the bill. Mr. Chair, on page 1, improvements are defined starting on 1.11, and then it goes into maintenance and what a municipal street is. And so all of those items are allowable under this bill for street improvement fees.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. That's helpful. I hadn't seen all the things laid out. It's obviously a large amount of things, which I'm not so sure that I like. The other thing that I was a little curious about is I see on line 2.18 that there's only 10 days notice by mail to the affected landowners, and it seems to me that people could be on vacation. You know, a lot of people are snowbirds. That seems like an awfully short period of time. Maybe that's standard. I'm just wondering how you settled on that amount of time.
Ms. Finn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, we would be more than happy to amend that number. There's no magic to it. It's probably typically how cities do other public notices, but if a 30-day or longer number gives comfort, we're happy to put that in.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Finn. That's helpful. Let's look at doing that. And then the other part about, can you just walk me through the next section, subdivision 5? says they can adjust the fees annually through part of the annual budget process using the truth in taxation notices. So would that require then the truth in taxation notice to have in writing that this is going to continue on or it's going to be adjusted? How would that work? It's not. I don't think that's very clear. So in other words, if you're going to raise the tax, would it be required in the truth in taxation notice that this is happening? How would that work? And then would people come to the truth in taxation hearing? Is that the public hearing part? Is that where they talk about it, or that they complain about it? I'm not quite sure how that works.
Ms. Spinn.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't have a good answer for that question. I don't know if council can help us with that at all, or if it needs to be cleaned up.
Ms. Dyson.
I think the idea is to be able to adjust the price based on maybe inflationary cost projects or things like that.
Representative Pepman.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and Ms. Spinn. Well, maybe we can look at that too, because I mean, to me this seems like it could be very vague and that the city could just send something out and it'd be very easy to slip through the cracks without, you know, people are used to getting their truth in taxation notice, but that doesn't necessarily alert them to the fact that there could be a big change coming up, and I'd want to make sure that they at least had the opportunity to know. It just seems like that would be fair, and I'm not sure that the night of the truth in taxation hearing would be the appropriate time. It seems like there should be a time sometime before that where people could come and get public input. And then, so let's look at that too. But then the other part that I kind of struggle with is the collection up to 20 years. That's an awfully long time, and I was just wondering how you came up with that term and or that number, and if that was flexible at all.
Ms. Dillon, I see Mr. Gustafson's coming back to the table. Mr. Gustafson.
Chair and committee members, the 20 years is typically referred to as the minimum life of a street. So it wasn't a number that was just plucked out there and is generally associated with the 20-year life.
Representative Pepman.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Any further questions for Ms. Finn? If not, I have Jill Larson. Ms. Larson, please state your name for the tape and begin with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Jill Larson. I'm with the Minnesota Business Partnership. Business Partnership joins the many listed organizations that are on, I think you have a handout in your packet listing all the organizations that are opposing House File 745. We have opposed this proposal for many years because we believe it would give cities the authority, the broad authority, to essentially create a new property tax and allow them to circumvent the existing special assessment and special taxing district laws. I know this isn't the tax committee, but just by way of quick background, businesses currently pay local property taxes like most other properties, but they also pay a state property tax. Businesses pay most of that tax. Cabins pay a small portion. And business property already pays an effective property tax rate about three times more than homestead property. So our concern is that the imposition of this street improvement fee or a tax, as we see it, would basically just widen that disparity and increase the cost of doing business in Minnesota. As was mentioned earlier, there's no requirement for the city to show any sort of a benefit to the businesses that will be assessed these costs. And our specific concerns about the proposal are in several areas. One is the definition of the street improvement district. It's very vague. The district could be drawn in any manner. As was mentioned earlier, it could be drawn in such a way that only business property was included in it, or even if other properties were included in the district, the way that the fee or tax would be assessed could theoretically fall almost entirely on business property. Concern with the sunset language in the bill. Now, there is language for a specific district that would sunset after 20 years, but if you read the language about the citywide district, This proposal is actually different than in past years, as I recall. This allows a city to essentially impose a street improvement fee, and the district would be the entire city. And there is no sunset in that language. So this essentially would allow the city to just create a new property tax on top of the existing ones across the entire city. And again, our concern is the way that this would be assessed. It wouldn't necessarily be assessed the way that the class rate is now. And so that's our concern, is that, that the plan that's listed in the bill, it says they have to have this hearing with 10 days notice. There's no requirement in the bill that the plan describe how the fee would be assessed, what the methodology is, how the cost would be apportioned. And so even though business owners would be allowed to come to the hearing, there's nothing in this bill that says that the plan would have to let them know how they're going to be assessed. So they might not even know what they want to say at the hearing because they don't know what they're going to be assessed. Finally, as was mentioned earlier, there are several other mechanisms that cities have that they can use for financing improvements, things like general property taxes, special service districts, special assessments, property tax abatements. These tools can and have been used in the past to do these street improvements, and we feel like those tools provide are more fair and a transparent mechanism to provide the services. So we would urge your opposition to the bill. Thank you.
The next person I have on my list is Janine Fox. And if you can be quick with your testimony, we've got other bills we need to get out of here today, too. So, Ms. Fox.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeannie Fox. I'm the Deputy Policy Director for the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. And we are a member organization of 2,000 nonprofit organizations all around the state in all activities of the charitable sector. And today we are standing with the most diverse coalition in MCN's history. From faith-based to nonprofit to private industry, we have everything here from the Girl Scouts to the truckers. And I think that's significant. I think a coalition of this size and significance of these entities and the various sectors represented indicates this policy is not a good precedent. As has been pointed out repeatedly, so I will be brief, the authority here is too broad, it can go unchecked for too long, and goes too far. And I'm going to speak solely on behalf of the nonprofit sector for a moment. This is an absolute end run around the historic, constitutionally protected, tax-exempt status of organizations of purely public charity. This has been, that exemption has been continually reaffirmed by the Minnesota State Legislature, most recently in 2009. So what can we do to support infrastructure? Obviously, we all recognize a need for continued investment. And I would say either they are special assessments and improvements, and yes, the cities will have to meet the bar, just as nonprofits who are eligible for property tax exemption have to meet criteria and a bar. Or they should be carried out under the existing property tax levy. I would encourage you to vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if anybody's noticed, but the governor actually took after the several of the nonprofits, including one that you mentioned, as a taxable entity in his bill. So I figured he must have looked up the constitutional basis for that before he put it out there. So I think this is probably as constitutional as anything else we're doing here.
Representative Gruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the last test bars. Ms. Fox?
Ms. Fox. She left so quickly before I could ask her questions.
Tried to wrap up.
So, Ms. Fox, you mentioned all of the nonprofit organizations that are opposed to this. What is Representative Earhart doing to the Girl Scouts with this bill?
I would say any organization that owns property and is found to be eligible to be exempt from the property tax exemption, these fees, which are very broad and long, could be applied to otherwise exempt property.
Representative Scouts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Fox, in downtown Edina, the Girl Scouts probably have an office somewhere on Main Street, and what would happen is they would be taxed out of their existence. Is that what you're afraid of?
Any
Ms. Fox.
Any dollars, thank you, Mr. Chair, any dollars paid to fees, Representative Drazkowski, would come directly out of program budgets and result in a loss of services to the community. I will point out that nonprofits have and always will pay special assessments. So there are times when that's appropriate and we pay our fair share as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
And Ms. Fox, so what you're telling us, Ms. Fox, is that the Girl Scout cookie proceeds are going to be stolen. Is that what you're telling us?
Ms. Fox.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, that is not what I'm saying. I did buy mine last night. I'm a good supporter.
Well, I said that, Ms. Fox.
Thank you. Representative Woodruff.
Thank you, Mr.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Tomorrow you have a bill that you've authored, 781, that's up. And I'm wondering, in light of that bill, if it doesn't make sense to lay this over until we can hear as a committee the scope of that particular bill, because in part it would exempt nonprofits and other organizations from paying.
It's your magnetic personality. Yeah.
Pardon me?
It's your magnetic personality.
Oh, yes, thank you. Well, appreciate that, Mr. Chair. But it in part says exempt from certain fees. A nonprofit organization is exempt from paying fees or charges imposed by cities that a fee or charge for a service provided by the city within the most recent 5 years that would have been paid by revenues received from property taxes or levies. I think that what Representative Earhart is proposing in 745 and what 781 do kind of run contrary to one another, and I think that we should, as a committee, hear both of those and then act on those bills accordingly.
Representative Driscoll, this was laid over from last week when we didn't get to it. We'll take action on this one today, and then we'll deal with the other one tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But again, from a public policy standpoint, it seems like today we're going to impose it, but tomorrow we're going to take it away from some folks. Why wouldn't we talk about both of them at the same time?
But they're scheduled the way they're scheduled, Mr. Chair. Any other questions? I think Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fox, just, you know, I'm fairly ignorant of local government and sometimes proud of that, but what really is the difference between a special assessment and these street improvement districts? Is it just scope?
Ms. Fox.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I, too, am not an expert on local government. My understanding is there would need to be benefit demonstrated from a special assessment in that it would actually improve the property, and nonprofits, even tax-exempt nonprofits, pay those assessments. And maybe Ms. Dyson would like to add more than that, but that is my understanding.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair.
Looking at Ms. Dyson there.
Representative Earhart, I don't know, maybe you can answer this question, but if the point is that you can assess properties if you're going to improve the value, is that a reasonable test to impose with the street improvement fee as well?
Well, I would think it would be, Mr. Chairman and Representative Winkler.
Representative Winkler.
My work here is done.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Driscoll.
I hate to come back to this one more time, but it might help me to decide how I would want to cast a vote on 745 today. Does the bill 781 fit within the scope of what we're talking about in 745? And I don't mean to put you personally on the spot as the author. I just really think it's important for me to know where we're at with this one.
Representative Driscoll, they do seem to run counter to one another, and this one's going to transportation, and we may or may not get to, with the agenda we have, we may or may not get to that other bill. So I right now we're dealing with this bill. Let's get this one taken care of, and we can move on to the rest of our agenda.
If I might ask just one more question, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I think I've been very fair in trying to put forward good public policy, and this one, for lack of a better term, looks like we're driving a semi through this. I'm confused if we have 745 in front of us, which says everybody's going to, and then it's coming out of government operations, but then we're going to start making exceptions. We're chasing the bill. We can't put it in good public policy form if we do that. And again, you're the chair, and you will have the control on how we want to do that, particularly as the author of this other bill. I would just, again, advise to you to maybe slow this down until we can get this issue resolved as well.
Mr. Chairman, remind him again that you're the chairman, will you? I think he's
Representative Earhart. Anybody else that needs to speak for or against this bill? If not, I see no further questions. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is certainly a big bill. I think it's been heard 6 or 7 times, probably, or at least been introduced. And, you know, it gives cities the opportunity to raise taxes without going through the property taxes. And we've had a lot of discussion over property taxes and who's responsible for raising property taxes. So I have to say I think that this is a bill we really should be steering clear of. And so I would like to ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been asked for. And Representative Earhart, one thing I heard through the testimony is I think you need to work with when it gets to your committee, work with the opponents, some of the suggestions they've made, some of the suggestions that have been made here from our members of this committee, and try and tighten some of those things up. And with that, the clerk will take the roll. And do me last.
Dill?
Yes.
Dorholt?
Yes.
Juskowski?
No.
Freiberg?
Yes.
Holt?
Yes.
Hansen?
Yes.
Kahn?
Yes.
Lean?
Aye.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Pepin?
No.
Sanders?
No.
Tice?
No.
Winkler?
Yes.
Nelson?
Yes.
Did I hit someone?
Oh, Pugh, you missed Pugh. Yeah.
No.
Pugh.
No.
My apologies.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Where was this bill going to next?
Transportation policy.
Thank you. And I assume it will go to, it's been to taxes, or has it been to taxes yet, Representative Earhart?
It may not have been, since I don't remember being there with it.
Or it may have been.
I don't believe it has.
What? Yeah. Texas has requested it.
It was 9-6 on 9 aye and 6 noes. The bill is passed and moved to transportation policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
And Representative Newton here. No, Representative Hornstein. And Representative Hornstein, I'll move your bill. House File 1219 to be passed and re-referred to transportation policy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for hearing House File 1219. Simple, straightforward bill, members. This comes out of not only my personal experience, but the experience of a number of my constituents and others who have dealt with meetings at the airport, at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. And we have had several meetings over the last few years, most recently in November, where we had a lot of citizen interest. I think we had over 200 people come to a MAC meeting during the day. And what happens when one attempts to go to a meeting at the Metropolitan Airports Commission boardroom is that you have to pass through airport security. Regular TSA security, as if you were going on a commercial airline flight. And not only that, you have to go downstairs, present your driver's license, have a security official write down information from your driver's license in order to get you a pass, and then instead of presenting the boarding pass at TSA security, then you get the slip of paper that you've been cleared previously to go. And so, members, this is just a bill to say, on occasions when the MAC anticipates a large turnout, they move the meeting from the airport grounds to a appropriate location near the airport where citizens would have access, where they don't have to front money for parking. Again, eventually I think they'll get reimbursed from the MAC. But not only do you have to front money for parking at the airport, then you have to go through security in order to attend a public meeting. And I think that's going way beyond what any public agency should do in order for the public to attend their deliberations. We need to encourage public engagement in all of our institutions, and to have to go through airport security in order to do so is, I think, way beyond the pale. It would be, let's say, Representative Drazkowski goes and he's upset about a tax assessment. He wants to go to the Mazeppa City Council. He can park his car, go right into the building, and then testify along with other citizens. Or, you know, let's say others of you have an interest, and your constituents have an interest. You can show up without having to go through security. So that's really the issue here, members. I'd be happy to take questions, and I hope you'll support House File 1219.
And before we go there, we've got the 11th grade students here from the United South Central High School over here. Welcome. And Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, I really like your bill. I don't think it goes far enough. And I wonder if you'd be open to an amendment, which I have cleared with Ms. Dyson. And that would be essentially to require all of their meetings to be free, all their public meetings to be free of the security area of the airport. So the amendment would be to strike on lines 1.9 everything through commission period. And so that would read commission meetings or hearings must be held outside of the airport security area and in a location where a person can attend without providing personal identification documentation. And then after that strike, a meeting or hearing is abroad, and then the whole rest of the next line. So the bill would simply say a commission meetings or hearings must be held outside of the airport security area and in a location where a person can attend without providing personal ID identification documentation.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. I would consider that a friendly amendment.
So, Mr. Chair, I would move that oral amendment. I think Ms. Dyson has it.
Representative Dill.
Thank you.
Comment on the amendment?
No. I'll wait until after the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think before we vote on the amendment, can we have MAC? If somebody from MAC is here that could talk about the bill, and obviously this makes it even more restrictive, and they, since it's an oral amendment that didn't have 24 hours notice, they have not had time to lobby anybody or talk to us about it, and so I think if we're going to accept this oral amendment, we should at least listen to what they have to say.
Why don't you come down and... Good point. I was going to do that before we voted on it. Mm-hmm. Representative Dill. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Chairman Nelson, Mitch Killian with the Metropolitan Airports Commission. Thanks, and thank you, Representative Pepin, for calling us down, because we do have some issues. I think that we've had some really good meetings with Representative Hornstein on the bill. We understand his concerns overall, and we want to be open to the public as best that we can within kind of reasonableness, but if it's okay, I'd like to just give you a little bit of testimony that I had prepared for the bill in general, but it's kind of about how our operation really works, because I think it speaks to your amendment as well, Representative Winkler, a little bit. If the bill does become law, there are some operational and logistical and possible open meeting law concerns that we have, none that are insurmountable. But we do, I think that giving you a little bit of background, especially as being the Governmental Operations Committee, about how things really work out there, it might be helpful. So if it's okay, Mr. Chairman. The MAC Commission meets as a full commission, and then there's three committees that meet also. Throughout the year, there's about 48 meetings a year that between committees and full commission meetings that take place. Of those, the majority of them have maybe 6 to 12 people from the public that attend, in addition to the MAC staff that are there. Most of the business that takes place is between businesses that we're doing business with or businesses that are working for us on business. As you can imagine, if you've been on city councils or school boards, most of our meetings are pretty mundane and don't have a lot of public interest. So about 48 a year. Out of those 48, probably I think that it's fair to say not more than 2 or 3 times, every 2 or 3 years. One number that I was given was every 2 to 4 years, but every 2 to 3 years, we have a pretty significant issue that pops up, which generates an additional amount of public interest, and it's fair to say that they're almost always centered on aircraft noise. And so when those issues do pop up, Representative Hornstein raises a real legitimate concern with how do you make sure and take public input on those issues. And so right now our commission meeting is located beyond security. We do validate your parking. You just bring your parking thing up and we do validate it. You go through the employee entrance, and there are some challenges to that, but that is where it takes place. But I didn't want to leave you with, like, that's the only opportunity for public input. When we take public input, first of all, you've got a commission. The full commission meets. Every issue goes through a committee structure, and so you normally go through a committee before that. Well, all those meetings take place behind. Then we've set up a noise oversight committee, which is made up of citizens that are affected, the most impacted communities around the airport that are affected by airplane noise, with the airport users, so the airlines. And they meet monthly. So city council members from Bloomington and Minneapolis and other affected communities sit down and work through noise issues that are very technical and lots of different pieces. Monthly they meet, and even twice a month issues pop up and they discuss issues and they advise the commission. And on top of that, we have quarterly meetings that we actually hold outside of the airport, where we actually have MAC staff and occasionally commissioners that attend, where we actually go out and just on a regular basis say, we're open. It's kind of open mic night on airplane noise to come in and discuss impacts of communities. It gives staff an opportunity to address kind of what's new and what's concerned with airplane noise. So I wanted to just make sure you understood kind of the process in general about how we work up and get things there. And on the latest issue, you probably read back in November, was on RNAV, a new departure procedure issue that Representative Hornstein kind of referenced the last meeting that we had. On that meeting, we met with, before that final vote, which I know is important for citizens to attend, but prior to that meeting, we actually met in city halls and individual city council members and other community groups that were interested in the issue. We met in a church basement in Minneapolis where over 100 people attended. We met in Egan Community Center where over 200 people attended to discuss the issues. So we just wanted to make sure and not leave the committee with the idea like there wasn't a bunch of public involvement before these things even went behind security where we finally met for the final votes. And we're sensitive and we want to work with Representative Hornstein on the bill, but there are issues that we need to deal with if this bill did move forward that we're going to have to work through. And so we're open for ideas. We want to work with it. Representative Hornstein has given us indication, but the majority of our meetings are pretty mundane, and they're dealing with the airport businesses that are on the airport or people that are doing business for us time in and time out. So the idea of moving it out of the airport is a pretty drastic jump in our minds.
So, Mr. Killian, are you okay with the bill as it was originally drafted, and then the amendment gives you heartburn? Can you live with the bill as it was originally drafted?
Chairman Nelson, members of the committee, there are some issues that I think that could be addressed in it. Representative Hornstein has given some indication. There's political issues of, on some occasions, sometimes it's communities have completely opposing views of on the issue. This last issue of RNAV, the south of the airport community really supported a different position than Minneapolis and Edina did. So if we were put into some type of box where we absolutely had to move off, picking a neutral location could be a challenge. If you found out only a couple days in advance that a small community neighborhood flared up and they were coming to it and you had to make quick adjustments, you know, we're open and we want to work with it, so I don't want to say that we're opposed to the bill. That's not the case, that we want to work with Representative Hornstein, but I just am trying to give you some legitimate concerns that we're going to have. If you have 250 citizens that are very concerned about an issue, you want to find a forum that kind of addresses that. Anybody that's been on a city council and been in those hot spots or a school board, you've got to be careful about what type of forum you pick, a gymnasium with bad noise and things like that. And they're not insurmountable, but they're real issues for us that we find ourselves dealing with.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Killian, first question is, when you say secured area, are you referring to the same type of security check that you would go through if you were a passenger on the airline?
Mr. Killian, quickly.
Chairman Nelson and Representative Dill, it is. What you do is you go down, you get a security pass, but you're checked for the no-fly list. It's all that you're doing is just being checked like that. You go up and you go through the employee security checkpoint, so you do go through the same exact scanning that you would as if you're a flying passenger, and then you go up to our commission meeting location.
Representative Dill.
So, Ms. Killian, so you got to take your shoes off, your belt off, and all that.
That's correct, Mr. Killian.
Okay. Okay, follow up as well.
Representative Dillon.
Thank you, Mr. Killian. How about the cost to MAC should this bill, either with the amendment or without the amendment, be placed on it?
Mr. Killian.
Representative Dillon, Chairman Nelson, you know, there's some cost. We don't want to overblow that argument. But, you know, depending on where you're going, you've got to rent a PA system. You might have to pay for a meeting location. Oftentimes, and we've done our ordinance process actually is the same as the city ordinance process where you have to hold a public hearing. We've been in Washburn High School for those public hearings. We've been in the Thunderbird Hotel. And so you've got Thunderbird Hotel type costs and things. Even high schools charge you. But you got those pieces. So there's a cost to us for sure, but I don't want to overstate it.
Representative Dill.
Last question, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Killian. How many times have the MAC gotten complaints, either written or verbal, about their inability to access a meeting?
Mr. Killian.
Chairman Dill, Representative Nelson, I don't have an exact number for you, but oftentimes when a policy decision is finally decided, somebody that didn't get completely what they wanted is oftentimes concerned about the process that it went through. That's the typical kind of piece that comes through. And I don't want to downplay that, but that is kind of what happens. And so you get a little bit of flare-ups about the process that it went through as a kind of a add-on to the policy decision of the outcome of the policy.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you for that. And so I'm listening to the arguments for and against this. It sounds like the NICS background check, universal background checks. It sounds like the wolf season. No matter which way you go, you catch the flack. So thank you, Mr. Killian, for the information.
Representative Freiberg. Representative Condon, were you on the bill or on the amendment?
I thought they're kind of combined.
Whatever. Representative Condon, yeah.
I just want to know, in any of these cases, can you... I know that you can't carry a gun to go into the airport. What about carrying a gun at other places at public meetings? I would be very concerned if we were limiting the ability to carry a gun to a MAC meeting.
Mr. Killian.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I understood the question.
That's a good position to take.
Representative Kahn.
I'm just interested in the Second Amendment right to carry. It clearly doesn't apply if the meeting is in the airport, but I'm interested in the meetings outside the airport.
Mr. Killian, I don't know if you want to touch that with the 10-foot pole, but
I definitely would have to look into it a little bit. It depends on if we're in Washburn High School or the Thunderbird Hotel, I'm sure, and some of those pieces of it. So,
well, I do believe that members of this legislature have put in bills to allow the right to carry in any school, so for officials, and I would assume that you guys would be officials. Well, just wanted to bring it up as an issue.
Sorry I brought it up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Freiberg.
Just a couple comments on the amendment. First of all, the MAC is in the Metropolitan Government Chapter of the Minnesota Statutes, and I'm generally of the mind that government should be held to the same standard. For that reason, I like Representative Winkler's amendment. It makes the language consistent. You know, in my mind, too, the bill, as it's drafted, vests a lot of discretion in the commission. You know, it's on line 1.9, which this amendment would delete. It says, you know, it's up to the commission to determine what meetings would be of a broad public interest. And just from my experience in the city council, you don't always know what is going to be of broad public interest. I like this amendment. You know, Mr. Killian said that the MACs met in other locations, including city halls, and it says to me that this amendment wouldn't be a problem. You know, maybe there's some sort of arrangement they could contract with the city of Bloomington to have the meetings regularly in the city hall there, which in my mind would be a very appropriate location for the meeting of a metropolitan government entity.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on the amendment and the bill, Mr. Killian, I think we did have a meeting in Eagan about 4 or 5 years ago, right, for public input, that the MAC did have a meeting there. Is that correct?
Mr. Killian.
Chairman Nelson and Representative Hansen, that's correct. We have held them. On an annual basis, we make a point to do an annual meeting off airport for the full commission where at least once a year we make sure and go and we circulate around and pick different locations where the commission does meet outside of security, and we usually try to tee up as a major agenda item for that night a noise type of discussion. So the Noise Oversight Committee has reported their annual work plan, what things they see coming forward, and a report on the issues that they've done. And so we have done We have done those on an annual basis.
Representative Hansen.
And Chair Nelson and Mr. Killian, Representative Hornstein, I'm sure that Mendota Heights would be a great location to have a meeting. We have plenty of facilities and opportunity. It'd be a great place, and it'd be close to the executive director's home, and be happy to reduce costs that way if you'd like to have a meeting in Mendota Heights. So, thank you.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Killian. I'm kind of torn on this bill because I like the idea of, you know, people being able to come to open meetings, and so I'm not really excited about having people having to go through security and all that stuff to go to a public meeting. And you talked about there's 48 meetings per year, so it sounds like you've got a lot of meetings, and it would be somewhat of a hassle, but I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about the specifics of that. You made a comment that kind of caught my attention. You said something about it's hard finding a neutral location. And I don't really know what that means. Is it because when you said that, it kind of triggered something to me that made it seem like for some reason you didn't want members of the public there? And that part I didn't like that much. And so I'm wondering what exactly would be the issue? Because it doesn't seem like it would be that hard to just, you know, get a nearby city council chambers that you could meet on a regular basis. Is it because of the cost? Is it because it's difficult for the people to get to that location because some of them are at the airport? I mean, I'm having a hard time understanding Mr. what the Kelly. Real problem would be.
Thank you, Representative Pepin and Chairman, and I'm really glad that you caught that. And if there's other ones that are really stuck with you guys about the way that I presented something, please let me know. Remember that a lot of this centers on aircraft noise. And if you're debating airplane noise around the airports, a lot of it is, hey, it would be nice if you could push it to somebody else. And so, or difference in opinions about policies, departure procedures, arrival procedures, and exactly how they're going to work. And so if we held too many meetings in South Minneapolis on occasion, there could be some folks from the other side of the airport. On the last issue on RNAV, I will tell you that Richfield had a complete different position than South Minneapolis. So if the Airports Commission was to pick Richfield City Hall or South Minneapolis, there's a real issue there. And it doesn't always come out in the public process, but we hear it. And just as you probably, when you're on city councils and school boards, you kind of feel it. We hear those issues to say you're too close to one group or another just by perception, even if it's not reality. It's just by perception of those things. So you do got to be cautious. I don't want to overstate any of these arguments, but they're out there on different issues that come up before us.
So you're talking about perception of bias.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Killian, well, couldn't you just rotate? I mean, I guess I don't have a strong position either way in this bill yet because I'm trying to understand what the issues are, but it seems like if you could just rotate it into different city areas, it wouldn't be a problem, and then people could actually attend without having to go through the whole rigmarole, and I like that idea, and I'm just trying to really get a sense of what. So that's one issue, the neutral location, and it seems like you could handle that by maybe moving it around. Might be some hassle, but once you got into a system, it seems like you could do that. Are there any other issues besides that? Is it difficult for certain members to get there? I'm trying to figure out what all the issues are before I decide how to vote.
Representative Pepin,
Mr. Keller.
I think that for the big issues that Representative Hornstein raises, that's the issue of the controversy of moving between locations and which location do you pick. If you're saying that we're going to move all of our meetings off the airport, I'd go back to out of 48 meetings, most of them the general public doesn't have a lot of interest in, and it really is airport business. It's people that are on the airport. Having the MAC commissioners, if you were actually MAC board members and you're attending these meetings, being part of the airport, being at the airport all the time, day in and out. Some days we have committee meetings that start at 9 o'clock in the morning, and they might be there to 1 or 2 in the afternoon with ribbon cuttings and all kinds of things that take place of the business of the airport. I'm not sure that I give you the full flavor of it unless you were really a commission member, but if you were a city council member from Bloomington and you were moving around into different locations, it makes it... It is our city hall. And it's a lot of the business of the airport that's taking place out there day in and day out. And it's people fly in and do business with us and then fly back out on the same day. So the idea of moving it around and just having the airports commission move around, one time you might have an Eden Prairie flying cloud airport issue, and it might just concern the tenants on the airport. The next one might be an issue that deals with an off-airport parcel of land where we're developing a non-aeronautical parcel. So to meet in Mendota Heights on that meeting would be very awkward and different, I think. or Anoka County Airport. Remember, we have six general aviation airports. The flood wall at St. Paul Downtown Airport. And so on an agenda, you might have the flood wall, then you have the Eden Prairie Airport, and then you have a major lease in the terminal building on gifts, on the gift shops, or versus a food and concessions vendor. And so the typical agendas on the commission meeting are pretty widespread. So 1 week to be in Richfield City Hall and moving those different tenant groups around.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Killian, well, that's helpful for me to understand this, and I'm sorry for asking so many questions, but I think it is important. What about, isn't there anywhere else in the airport property that you could have these meetings that don't involve having to go through security, so it would be, could solve both problems?
Mr. Killian.
Representative Pepin and Chairman Nelson, that is very possible. There's a pretty big cost associated with that to build a facility and to move that and to make and have the proper facility and things in place. But we have looked at, and with future improvements, we always are looking at the possibility of, on the front side of the terminal, or where the rental car concessions are, is there an opportunity for us to do it out there? We have been looking at opportunities to see if there are spots out there, but there's a pretty big cost. I will tell you that where the commission meets in the commission chambers, there's a conference center up there that we use frequently, and we rent out that space as a conference center. Medtronics and other major corporations use that conference center on a regular basis, and so they can actually fly in people. There's large rooms and small rooms, and conduct business at the airport and then fly back out. But in addition to that, they have a lot of local people that come to the meetings that aren't using the airport, that we can have a pass made up with them the same way that the public process is. And many corporations and businesses choose to use that conference center all the time because they don't feel it's such a challenge. The parking is convenient. You go through employee checkpoint. And so that conference center is located inside the terminal just for that reason, so that people can actually fly in and fly out. So we probably would still have our conference center and have that set up, and then we would build another facility outside of security. And that is a legitimate possibility for the future at some time as capital improvements are take place at the airport that we can look at.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just be brief. And Mr. Killian, actually, you highlighted a couple of things that I think make this important, which is, number one, the airport does not receive any tax funding from the state, so there is no requirement that the airport commission come back to the legislature for full accountability or scrutiny. And that means that all the routine, mundane, ordinary business that you do with your vendors and with the people who lease space at the airport and all of those people are done sort of outside of other public process. And I think it makes it even more important that it be open and available to the public and to the press, that I think by having these barriers in place, you put a chilling effect on that. And so I think because it is so separate and because it is sort of its own unique little self-contained world, it makes it all that much more important to make it accessible. And it just, with all the construction at the airport, it doesn't seem like building a conference room that's available to the public would be such a major departure on expenses.
No further questions. Is there anybody else that needs to testify for it? Is this the Representative Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, I am so sorry that this issue has gotten to the point that I had to take a legislator to determine whether or not we're going to be inside or outside the fence at the MAC on something like this. This committee has spent 20 minutes talking about this matter. And to the officials from the MAC, I would hope that we would never have to hear something like this again as to where you hold your meetings. That common sense would prevail on all sides on this. I think that we're at the Minnesota State Legislature arguing about where a meeting is going to be held. I think that these elected officials and folks who are here for other business in front of this committee are being done a disservice.
Representative Drazkowski, quickly, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Killian, Representative Dill asked a question about how prevalent the complaints are about the venue for meetings. And you mentioned it would be tough to estimate how many complaints you get. What could you estimate as a percentage of the people who attend what that frequency would be?
Mr. Killian, quickly.
Driscoll and Chairman Nelson, at the last meeting, the RNAV meeting, that was the latest noise meeting, 230 people came. We made sure and give them proper notice about being at the proper checkpoint and where to be and things. All 230 people got through, and the meeting started relatively on time, within a few minutes of the actual starting time that people came, got through, and were able to testify. We took 3 hours of testimony, and everybody was heard, and a compromise was reached on the issue. At that meeting, I don't remember a lot of people or that we took documentation of how many people showed a lot of concern and said, boy, that was unbearable and things, the times and when we met and pieces of it. But I don't have an easy estimate for you. I'm sure on occasion, or someone would say, I've never been asked. So they would say that if they were asked, maybe they would complain about it. But we didn't have a huge outcry at that meeting to say, boy, this was very inconvenient for us or we weren't able to make it.
Representative Drazkowski.
That's just one meeting. So,
Mr. Killian, your estimation, is it greater than 10% or less than 10%?
Mr. Killian, greater or less? Greater or less?
I choose less, but we do have some regular citizens that come.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Killian. How out of the meetings that you hold, how many of them are controversial and have this level of controversy? I imagine most of them are mundane, but what percent are controversial?
Mr. Killian, quickly.
Representative Nelson, one every 3 or 4 years, and I would look to Representative Hornstein to confirm my number.
I see him shaking his head.
Well, there's several a year, I think, or every couple years, yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it sounds like not real frequent. I'm like Representative Pepin, kind of torn on this bill, but thank you.
We have Representative Winkler's amendment. Does everybody understand what the amendment does? Do we need to repeat it? If not, all in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
I didn't hear the amendment.
Representative, okay. Ms. Dyson, can you repeat the amendment?
Mr. Chair and members, the oral amendment would be to, on page 1, line 9, delete everything before must, page 1, line 11, delete everything after the period, and page 1, delete line 12, so that it would read, commission meetings or hearings must be held outside of the airport security area and in a location where a person can attend without providing personal identification documentation.
Everybody clear now? All in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Amendment passes. I'm now on the bill, as amended. I'll renew my motion that House File 1219 be passed as amended and re-referred to transportation policy. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you.
Representative Newton, we've been waiting for you. And if you can go quickly, I understand this is a complicated issue, but it looks like a complicated, but it's a simple issue. And if we can be concise, I'll move House File 1138 to be passed and re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This may appear complicated, but actually all it is an alignment of the Minnesota Code of Military Justice with the Universal Code of Military Justice, which is the federal code that prescribes judicial and non-judicial punishment and how the military will address things such as court-martials and lesser punishments. With me today, I have Don Kerr from the department. This is an agency bill, by the way. Major Lindsay Olson, also from the JAG office, who would like to testify to the bill, if anyone has questions on it at all.
And I guess my main question is, and maybe you can address that in your comments, short comments, that why is it important that we line these two up? I think that's the big question on the bill. Why is it important to line these two codes of justice up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I'm Don Kerr. I'm the executive director of the department. Of Military Affairs, the senior civilian executive of the agency. General Nash is not able to be here today. He's traveling to D.C. Minnesota Statute 192 Alpha has been in existence since 1963. It is the Minnesota Code of Military Justice. It exists because members of the National Guard, when they're under state control, are not subject to the federal code. As the federal code has evolved, we have not really kept pace in Minnesota or in any other state. All 54 states and territories have their own code to account for the authority of the state when soldiers are not in a federal status. This is really what we see as a routine update to keep up with the federal code to make them more consistent. And we see this as being important right now because we have a lot of service members and members of the chain of command who have become accustomed to using the Uniform Code of Military Justice to instill discipline in their force during their federal deployments, and the Minnesota Code does not mirror very closely the Uniform Code anymore. So we've proposed basically 8 fundamental changes in this update. The last time we opened the statute was, I believe, 1994, so about every 10 years we're looking to update this to bring more into line. And I did provide some materials in advance to the committee that should be in your folders, a 2-page white paper that we believe lays out the case pretty well, along with a 1-page summary of the 8 major changes, and I'll adjust those very rapidly. Our first one is to adjust the court-martial convening authority for general courts-martial. Currently in statute, only the governor can call a general court-martial. That's a fairly archaic methodology. In the active component, any general officer in the chain of command has the authority to convene a general court-martial, and we think a similar authority for the adjutant general and other general officers in command potentially would be appropriate. This depoliticizes the court-martial process, and it's an issue that we had concerns about in the agency. Typically, a general court-martial is only convened when an officer is going to be disciplined, and there is some concern that the agencies may be restrained from asking the governor to convene a court-martial under certain circumstances, for example, in an election year or around a politicized event. And we feel that by delegating this authority to the adjutant general, it makes it much more usable as a provision. We also felt that the code currently is really lacking in appellate authority, and this aligns appellate authority within the Minnesota Code into the appellate court system in Minnesota, which is a little unusual and was not addressed previously. We have, when the original statute was written regarding the bullet number 3, the warrant powers to align with duty definitions, we're very conscious of what authority status our soldiers are serving in at any time, and we are limited from imposing certain disciplines to very specific sections. And right now, a soldier who's serving in an active guard and reserve status, like Major Olson is, technically we have no authority to impose the code in that case, and that was not the original intent, but these statuses have morphed over the years. This expands the authority to cover all of those statuses. We do have an adjustment for jurisdiction over certain crimes committed outside duty status. Specifically, this gets back to our urinalysis program. We do test our soldiers and airmen, and technically we cannot prove right now if they come up, fail the urinalysis, that they committed the crime while they were in a duty status and therefore have no jurisdiction and cannot take judicial action or disciplinary action against them, only administrative action, and we think that should be adjusted. The non-judicial punishment rules are currently not aligned with the model code that was directed by Congress in 2003 that the Secretary of Defense review and propose a model code to make the 54 states and territories more in alignment, and this is one of those things that we think needs to do that. We currently have summary court-martial authority, but the restrictions for the summary court-martial are almost as imposing as a special court-martial or a general court-martial, and that really reduces or eliminates the utility of having a summary court-martial authority, which again is a disciplinary tool that does not result in a criminal conviction, but is an additional tool for commanders to instill discipline in the force. We add clarity to the limits on punishment by court-martial, and that's fairly concise right now. It's really tied to archaic standards, and this would tie it to a civil court structure. And we have a weakness in the general article, which is an article that is typically used in the process of administering non-judicial or judicial punishment. With that relatively complicated but I hope expedient description, I will stand for questions or bring Major Olson forward.
Representative Pettman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Newton. I guess my question is, I'm not clear as to what our jurisdiction is over this bill. I want to keep it in the jurisdiction, but I'm confused as to why it would be in this committee as opposed to state government finance, which also covers Veterans Affairs. Which
section.
The reason it's in our committee is because it gives more power to the Adjutant General, which is government operations, and that's why we're hearing it. The judicial parts of this will be heard in the Judicial Committee. So it's basically we're debating whether we want to give more powers. We're taking powers away from the governor, I believe, under the court-martial piece. We're moving that to the Adjutant General. And so I think we're giving more power to the Adjutant General.
Mr. Chair, if I may, we're not taking power away from the governor. We're permitting the governor to delegate power to the attorney or to the Adjutant General.
Thanks for the correction, Representative. And state government is veterans issues. This is not a veterans issue. This is a National Guard issue, which active military, which is our jurisdiction.
Mr. Chair, what section of the bill should we be directing our questions from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, virtually any portion of this bill that mentions the authority of the Adjutant General, and I would say starting on line 411 and then 416 and it throughout the bill, what it does is it grants the authority that already rests with the governor without taking any authority away from him, but it grants that authority also to the Adjutant General. So the Adjutant General can conduct courts martials and is responsible for the discipline and relieving the governor of that responsibility unless the governor wants to retain it.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Newton, this does not need to go to state government? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, it has to go next to judicial because of the appellate rule on it where it would go to the Court of Appeals and then from there to state government and Veterans Affairs.
So we'll go there?
Yes.
Eventually. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Anyone else that needs to testify for or against this bill? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 1138 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Passed.
Thank you, Mr. Committee. The next bill I have on the committee on the agenda is 1219, Representative Anzell. 1320. I'm sorry. I looked at the wrong side of my number. Representative Anzell, if you could be concise, would be helpful.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I have a two-hour dissertation on the history of mining.
Lay this on the table.
Mining accidents on the Mesabi.
There's an amendment here. Is this your amendment?
Yes, it is. There are two of them, I believe.
Okay. Which one do you want? Do we need to do first? I've got an A1, and I got a
A1, please.
Okay. I'll move the A1 amendment, and can you tell me what that does? Representative Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a technical amendment that I recommended. It corrects the head notes in a couple of places to match the text that's been amended and also corrects a citation in the special assessment statute so it refers to the actual collection process and not just definitions.
If there are any questions on that amendment, we'll take all in favor of the A1 amendment. Please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. The amendment is adopted. And the 174 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment is here at the request of one of the major stakeholders in this piece of legislation, which are the 4,000 miners represented by the United Steelworkers of America. And I have with me the acting St. Louis County Mining Inspector, Mr. Joe Austin, who can answer any questions you have about this amendment.
Mr. Austin, if you want to explain the amendment, and please state your name for the tape first.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, my name is Joseph J. Austin. I'm the Director of Safety and Risk Management for St. Louis County. I'm the Acting Mine Inspector. The amendment before you is the result of many meetings that we've had with the stakeholders that are involved with this, who include mine employees, mine safety committees, the Steelworkers Union, Mine Management, and the Iron Mining Association, and the people that they represent. In particular, a couple things to point out in here, where it says 1.5, they had talk, we had the request that we be very specific about requiring 2 years of experience in safety and mining, practical experience as a miner. And then on the bottom, where it talks about the descriptions of accidents, that was something that was a request to get put in by the Iron Mining Association, primarily because we wanted to get away from defining cause of accident in our annual report.
Okay, so there's peace in the valley on this amendment?
Correct.
All in favor of the A13-0174 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion approved. The amendment's adopted. Briefly describe your bill, and my understanding is that there's peace in the valley in this bill, that all interested parties are in agreement on this, and Representative Van Zyl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're absolutely correct. There is agreement between the 4,000 miners affected by mine inspections, the mining companies, and the union that represents the miners. I can tell you very briefly, as a third-generation family coming from a mining background, that this is crucial to the health and safety and lives of over 4,000 miners currently working on the Mesabi. This statute that we're clarifying and correcting here has been in law since 1905. And I can tell you, as a youngster some 60 years ago, living in a mining company house at the edge of a mine, on a weekly basis, the sirens would go off, and my mother would tell me that another miner was hurt or at sometimes fatally injured in a mining accident. Tremendous progress has been made, largely because of the efforts of the St. Louis County Mine Inspectors Operation. They contract with Itasca County to provide mine inspections on the properties located in Itasca County. And today, whether you go to a union hall or whether you visit with executives from the companies, everybody is on the same page, and everybody is as interested in mine safety as possibly can be. So that's basically the bill, and I ask for your consideration.
Any questions? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Van Zyl, can you tell us, would this have application to the sand mining in southeast Minnesota as well?
Representative Van Zyl.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, I was hoping somebody would ask that question. The answer is no. This involves ferrous mining only.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Van Zyl, as a Metro member, I'm happy to support this bill. I appreciate your changing some very old law here, and I applaud you for doing so.
Thank you.
Anybody else in the audience that needs to speak for or against this bill? Looks like they must have peace in the valley, because no one's coming up to scream about it. So with that...
Just like your other bills you've heard today.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1320 be passed as amended and re-referred to labor, workplace, and regulated industries. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I've spoken with the chair of the committee that you apparently have referred this to, and he does not indicate an interest in seeing the bill. And I would recommend, or I would suggest, that this bill is ready to go to the general register.
Representative Van Zyl, I've been told that it's got to go to labor workplace, so I haven't been told that, so we'll get it. If we have to, we can change the motion on the floor.
Thank you.
That motion has been passed, so thank you, sir. And
thank you very much.
And the last bill we have is Representative Freiberg's 1120. If we can do this quickly, hopefully there's not a lot of controversy. Representative Freiberg,
I don't believe
you want to move your bill?
Sure. I will move that House File 1120 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee.
That's what I'm supposed to go. That's what I've got.
Yeah.
Representative Freiberg.
Oh, does everybody, there's a handout, I understand, that I think people should have? Oh, yeah.
That's going around now.
Okay, great. Judge Eric Lippman is here from the Office of Administrative Hearings, but you're getting a handout right now. There are two types of cases that ALJs in the state hear. Under current law, the cases in the left column have the ALJ served with any documents in an appeal right now. The right column is where it just goes to the agencies. So the bill just makes a simple change that OAH has requested so that the ALJ is not a party in either case. Basically, the reason is it's sort of unseemly to have a judge as a party in a case, you know, saying, I was right, you know, you should uphold the decision. But Judge Lippman can speak.
Judge Lippman,
if
you want to introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you kindly, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Eric Lippman. I'm the Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge for the Administrative Law Division. As Representative Freiberg said, this is a tale of two types of cases. As he suggested, in the right-hand column, these are representative examples of the kind of work that we do, but not an exhaustive list. A judge, like myself, would take the case, hear from the parties, the agency staff, and undoubtedly the citizen or corporate party on the other side. We'd have a trial. I would make a recommendation for a final decision by an agency head, the very good-looking group at the top there. And this is about 90% of the type of work that we do, that which is in the right-hand column, or at least exemplified by those. In 10% of the cases, the kinds of cases which are represented in the left-hand column and others, I stand in the shoes of the agency, and rather than have my report signed off on or agreed to or modified or made by an agency head, I make the final decision on behalf of the agency. As a result, because of a glitch in the way that 14.63 is written, OAH is joined as a party respondent in the litigation if there's a later appeal. Now, as a judge, you know, if I'm wrong in a decision, I'm glad to have the Court of Appeals correct me on that. If I'm right and they affirm the decision, I'm delighted. But I don't have a policy stake in the same way that the agency does in the right-hand column types of cases. They're defending a particular view of the statute and where policy should go. The language that Representative Freiberg has suggested, I think, gets to the right result in both types of cases, which is the people that are litigating in front of me are also the parties to the later appeal, and that OAH isn't dragged into the litigation on the appeal, doesn't have to pay for the Attorney General's fine services in the appeal. We don't have to explain to people that, no, the lower court isn't going to be participating in the litigation. And folks aren't sending us or spending the resources to send us copies of the filings in litigation that we're not going to pursue. So if members are looking for an opportunity to save money, to reduce confusion, by members of the public, boost public confidence, this is a simple and nice way to do that, and no doubt will be Representative Freiberg's re-election bill. So we're grateful for his kindness and the committee's time as well.
Any questions of the testifier or of Representative Freiberg? Is there anybody in the audience that needs to testify for or against the bill? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 1120 be passed and re-refer to Judiciary and Finance Policy Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. The bill is...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you. Thank
you.
Bill is passed. Yeah, no problem. And with that, members, we have our journey's done for today, and we have a meeting tomorrow, and hopefully we have an aggressive agenda for the next couple of days, and hopefully we can get through as much of that as possible. We've also reserved a room for Thursday night, if need be, if we're to get done, so we can get through these things and get the bills that we need to get passed. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.